the referral to a transplant center can come from anywhere. It can come from, it doesn't have to come from the nephrologist. It can come from the primary care physician. It can come from the patients themselves. So just knowing that, recognizing that this is the best therapy for chronic kidney disease, and helping, you know, say to patients, hey, you know, you've got advanced chronic kidney disease. I see your GFR is, you know, 24. Have you thought about transplant?
Welcome to Up My Nursing Game, the educational nursing podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. I am your host, Annie Fulton. Listeners of this podcast can claim free CE credits for each episode through VCU Health. See the link in the show notes or at upmynursinggame.com. You asked and I hope to deliver. Today's episode is about kidney transplants. A listener requested an episode about solid organ transplant, which is a great topic for all nurses. Nurses can care for patients on different parts of their transplant journey. Some may be waiting for an organ on a transplant list, and others may be years out from a successful transplant and on a standard medication regimen. While today's guest, Dr. Silas Norman, is a transplant nephrologist and will speak specifically about kidney transplant, a lot of what we will discuss can be applied to other transplanted organs. And if nothing else, kidneys are by far the most commonly transplanted organ and the one that you are most likely to encounter. One humble request before we begin. If you are enjoying this podcast and feel that it's adding value to you and your career, please like, share, and subscribe. Okay, listen in. All right, welcome to the episode. We have Silas Norman, a co-medical director of kidney and pancreas transplantation at the University of Michigan. I'm so excited to have you on today to talk about kidney transplant. So welcome, Dr. Norman.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What led you to this specialty of kidney and pancreas transplant?
So thank you. I've had a lifelong interest in helping people and communities to be healthy. I originally thought that was going to lead me into internal medicine to be a primary care physician. I was fortunately exposed to nephrology during my internal medicine residency, came to love it, and it seemed another way to help people. And then during my nephrology fellowship training, I met my research mentor, Dr. Ojo, who helped really cement my commitment to going into nephrology and then subsequently into transplant nephrology.
Can you explain the difference between more traditional nephrologist who say is maybe working with dialysis patients versus a transplant nephrologist, maybe the breakdown of nephrology at the institution that you're at?
Oh, sure. Individuals who are nephrologists take care of people with kidney disease, really across the spectrum of kidney disease. Many individuals, which we consider general nephrologists, typically will take care of people who initially develop kidney disease, really through most of their advancement of their chronic kidney disease, really working on prevention and slowing down. They'll take care of people in the hospital. And then when people have advanced kidney disease, there's a few options for management of advanced kidney disease, including hemodialysis, peritoneal dialysis, which nephrologists also manage, and then kidney transplantation. And because kidney transplantation requires a relative amount of specialized knowledge in terms of medications and a number of regulatory issues, there's a number of us who really focus solely on transplant. And so what myself and my colleagues do is we take care of individuals and evaluate individuals who might need kidney transplants. So we walk them through that process, and then we take care of patients after transplantation, hopefully for a long, long time.
Yeah, I'm sure you must develop quite a relationship with your patients to see them through this journey.
We do. And I think that's actually one of the best parts of the job, is that when we do it well, we really have the opportunity to know people over years, sometimes decades. You end up being able to talk to people about their kids, sometimes about their grandkids over the course of taking care of them. So it's terrific.
Yeah.
One aspect of organ transplant that I am passionate about is that in some real ways, you're really solving a problem. And I think it's so amazing to see patients, especially the younger patients for whom they're on dialysis, they get a kidney and then they're able to get off of dialysis. With the caveat being that you kind of have to frame transplant as trading one diagnosis for another, and it's not smooth sailing by any means, but to be able to get someone off of dialysis must be a hugely gratifying experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're right that transplant is a treatment, not a cure for chronic kidney disease. But as you mentioned, it's the most effective treatment. It extends life expectancy tremendously and really allows people to get back to normal life. What they were doing and would like to have been doing really before dialysis really impacted their life. So,
yeah, absolutely. So I think the bulk of this conversation will probably be about the post-transplant patient, but I think it's also important for nurses to understand, you know, the pre-transplant phase here, because I know one problem with organ transplant is that there are a lot more people who are eligible for a transplant than are worked up and on a transplant list. If you could just start talking about that initial funnel of getting a patient on the kidney transplant list. What does that look like?
Sure. So when we think about the ideal way for people to come to transplant, ideally we would transplant people when they have advanced chronic kidney disease, but before they ever need dialysis. And beyond that, if whenever possible, we transplant them with a living donor kidney, as opposed to a deceased donor kidney. To do that effectively means that you have to have people referred to a transplant center in a timely manner to give time to work up. When we look at people with advanced chronic kidney disease, as you probably know, we're often looking at people's GFR or their kidney function. People can be placed on the transplant waiting list when they have a GFR of 20 milliliters per minute or less.
Okay.
And that number, you know, in context, many people who start dialysis are starting dialysis closer to 10. And so ideally, between getting them on the list at 20 and them needing dialysis at 10, hopefully that's a number of years so that they have an opportunity to get transplanted before needing dialysis. In order to do that well, though, that means that you have to have them evaluated before they hit 20. And so in general, we want them to be evaluated when the GFR is 25 or less, so that ideally we have time to get the patient completely worked up and all their testing done, so they're ready to go. So by the time they hit 20, we can get them on the list and start helping them accumulate waiting time. That doesn't happen all the time for a couple of reasons. One of them on the physician end is just it means that you have to start talking to your patient about the decline of their kidney function and about, you know, treatment options when the kidney's, you know, function is not adequate for them a lot earlier than you need to start talking about dialysis options. And so, you know, many people are sometimes uncomfortable starting that conversation. And so we kind of put it off and put it off and put it off and don't get it done on time. Many people, even among nephrologists, just aren't aware of the 20 milliliter per minute cutoff and opportunity for people to start accumulating waiting time. And so they inadvertently refer people late. And then we know that there are some biases among medical professionals where we may think particular patients, you know, aren't going to be good candidates for transplant. And so then we don't refer people in a timely manner.
What do you think those biases are?
So we know from some historical data that all things being equal, we know that African Americans are less likely to be referred in a timely manner than their white counterparts. This is a little interesting because there's both the question of whether people have sort of some racial biases where they think people might not be good candidates, but also interestingly in dialysis, there's this paradox where compared to white patients, overall African Americans as a group tend to have somewhat better dialysis survivals than their white counterparts for a couple of reasons. But knowing that piece of data has been translated a little bit by people to think African Americans do well on dialysis, so there's no urgency in referring, rather than understanding that sort of relatively speaking, everyone does poorly on dialysis. African Americans happen to do slightly less poorly.
that's a good way of framing the situation.
But I think from the transplant center standpoint, we would suggest that everyone, you know, who we think is medically appropriate be referred. Let the transplant center decide medical candidacy. Let the transplant center social workers work with the patient in terms of transportation and support and so forth, and not preempt that decision.
Yeah, absolutely. So I could see where kidney transplant is at the forefront of the mind of a general nephrologist who works at a kidney transplant center. But for, you know, patients who are seen at, you know, smaller hospitals where there is not kidney transplant, I could see where this could fall through the cracks, right? Where a patient is not referred. What do you think a nurse could do to advocate for a patient in that situation, a nurse who works at a smaller institution without kidney transplant, to communicate to the patient about, you know, in such a way to advocate for being evaluated for a transplant?
Yeah, that's a great question. We know that patients do better when they have a team, when they have a support team around them. Nurses can play a tremendous role because the nurses, our nurses tend to know, they know their patients, you know, as well as the physicians, sometimes better. Taking care of them, they're a trusted source of information. And, you know, the nurse can help, I think, both by identifying patients who have advanced chronic kidney disease. I think helping educate patients, I think events like these where we help educate the community so that nurses are empowered to know the options for patients. You know, importantly, recognizing that the referral to a transplant center can come from anywhere. It doesn't have to come from the nephrologist. It can come from the primary care physician. It can come from the patients themselves. So just knowing that, recognizing that this is the best therapy for chronic kidney disease, and helping, you know, say to patients, hey, you know, you've got advanced chronic kidney disease. I see your GFR is, you know, 24. Have you thought about transplant? You know, and if not, you know, helping give them a little bit of information. There's a lot of educational resources out there, particularly on the web for patients that are patient friendly, helping direct people to information. And then sometimes just bringing it up to the physicians to say, hey, you know, while we're, you know, managing their diabetes and high blood pressure, et cetera, to do this in a timely manner, we really need to be making this referral now.
Yeah, I love that. Maybe this would be a good time to speak to, you know, what does that workup process look like?
When we are evaluating people for transplant, there's a medical, surgical, and psychosocial component of that evaluation. As you're aware, the major cause of death in people with advanced chronic kidney disease is cardiovascular disease. We have an excess of heart attacks and strokes in our patients. And so for the medical workup is really primarily directed towards evaluating that risk. And so pretty routinely, depending on the patient, people can expect to get an echocardiogram. Many patients will require a heart stress test to make sure that their heart is okay. Many patients, particularly our patients with diabetes who are likely to have more vascular disease, often will be required to have a CT scan of their pelvis so we can look at the blood vessels that we need to sew into to make sure that they're good technical targets. We need to evaluate people's body weight, particularly their abdominal weight, because that's where we're going to place the transplant. So we need to make sure that that's feasible. And then from a psychosocial standpoint, we're going to look to see what their support system is like, because particularly early after transplant, people are going to need individual around to help them with their medication, to help them with simple things like cooking and so forth. You know, when they're early post-op and can't move around, they'll need reliable transportation to get back and forth to the transplant center. And so we evaluate all of those issues. And particularly because we don't all have control of how quickly testing gets done, it's important that we start in a timely manner, because it may take 3 months before you can get that stress test, you know, scheduled and completed, particularly for folks, you know, who are working and have kids and have other, you know, things to do besides this evaluation. And so we often talk about the worst thing that happens if we evaluate someone early is we say that it's too early, come back when the kidney function has progressed a little bit. There's really no downside to that, except that someone perhaps spent half a day, you know, in evaluation and it's too soon. That's okay. But that's better than too late.
Yeah. Yeah. I work at a large academic center. I see dentists come in sometimes. Yeah. Is that part of the kidney workup as well as a dental exam?
You know, it can be. And actually that can often be one of the biggest challenges to getting people worked up, in part because depending on what insurance people have, many insurance companies will require dental clearance before people are approved, independent of sort of what the clinical assessment is. You know, and as you know, in many places around the country, there's really a deficit of dental care. And so a lot of people don't have easy access to dental care. And it becomes, at least at our center, often one of the biggest barriers to getting people listed, because we think they're otherwise okay, but they're required to have this dental clearance and there's just no dentist around. So that can be a huge thing. And you're fortunate. If you have a dentist who comes into the center, that's tremendous.
Yeah, we do. But I realize that we're very, very fortunate to have these kind of resources there. But often I'm seeing like these expedited workups where a patient has to be hospitalized in order to get a workup. But what you're describing sounds like it can all be done in an outpatient basis.
Ideally, that's the way we'd like to do it. And none of these tests in and of themselves require being inpatient. It's all outpatient. And if we can get all that testing done, make sure that their heart is okay, blood vessels are okay, the body weight is okay, physical function is good, you know, they've got it identified support, we've got a transportation plan, you know, then we can just kind of sit still, wait to see, you know, it when and if the kidney function declines to 20. And as soon as we get a lab that shows 20, we can get people on the list. The other thing, in addition to them accumulating waiting time, which is the main way you move up on the kidney transplant waiting list, is it gives people more time to think about living donors, who might be living donors for them, to ask those living donors for us to work up the living donors as well.
That's right. So that's a really interesting part of the discussion here is how can you get matched to a living donor? Like what criteria are you looking for a match?
Sure. So generally speaking, we try to just emphasize to people what you just, you know, the only thing you need ultimately is someone who's healthy and is interested in donating to you. That's really kind of the bottom line. We do need for the eventual donation, we are going to need somebody who's blood type compatible. And we do some testing to make sure that the transplant candidate does not have any antibodies against their potential donor. But we want to emphasize that that's not a hard stop. So people shouldn't, you know, not have their, you know, interested person come in because they think they might not have a compatible blood type, because there's a number of programs across the country, what we call paired donation programs, where essentially swap donors. And so it may be that you have a otherwise healthy person who's not compatible with you, but they're going to be compatible with someone. And so we can essentially swap donors so that you get transplanted, you know, another pair gets transplanted. So the most important thing is just finding people who are interested. The transplant center will make sure that they're healthy enough, and then we can help people understand what their options are, whether it's direct donation or whether we should go through one of the paired donation programs.
Okay. In order to be a good candidate for being a donor, you have to be the same blood type? Or can it be like a, say, for example, if someone is type O, they can donate to anyone?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So it just has to be compatible. So exactly as you say, so similar when people think about blood transfusion, you know, it just needs to be a compatible blood type. So the O's can donate to anybody, the ABs can receive, you know, from anybody. And then even within there's some additional wiggles, for instance, where some of our candidates who have ABO who are a B blood type, in general, they would need a B kidney, but it turns out there's actually some people who have a blood type A kidneys that would be appropriate for those candidates. And so I think important is that people don't prejudge such and such as not compatible. Let the transplant center do some testing, because there are a number of options for how those transplants can happen.
Yeah. No, that's really neat to know that if you find someone who is healthy and willing to donate a kidney, who's not a match to you, it can still be advantageous to you to be able to get on this paired, to be part of the paired, what did you say?
Paired donation.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. That's neat. Okay. So what are the common reasons why you would say a patient is not a candidate for receiving a transplant? And maybe talk about the progression of kidney disease and why do you want to intervene early on in their kidney disease?
Sure. The main reason to do kidney transplant is that it improves survival compared to dialysis. People live longer and they feel better. And so as we're evaluating folks, we're really looking at issues that are going to impact their ability to undergo surgery and issues that are going to impact their longer term Medically, the issues we're looking at, you know, as you mentioned, are heart disease. There are a small group of patients who have heart disease that's so advanced that they're not reasonable candidates for transplantation because we think their risk of death associated with their heart disease is so high that they're not going to benefit. More commonly, some people are too heavy. So from a technical standpoint, it's just hard to do the procedure. That doesn't have to be a forever hard stop because we'll give people recommendations for increased activity and weight loss, and those patients can come back, you know, potentially and be good candidates in the future. One of the things medically that we've really recognized and focused on more is what we call functional status or evaluation of medical frailty. This idea that, and we all have some idea of sort of people being frail, and we have some ways of measuring that, the people who are it probably is, you know, people would understand that people who are pretty medically frail may not do great with a abdominal surgery and may not recover well. And we have ways of measuring that, looking at things like how quickly people can walk, how far people can walk, what activities people can do. And so sometimes that will be a barrier to transplant. But again, in the ideal, we can get people stronger. We can get them moving better and becoming better candidates. And then one of the, in terms of psychosocial issues, that can also become a barrier. We often want people to have a main support person and then a backup support just in case. Some people really can't identify those folks. It doesn't mean they don't have people interested in their health, but it may be that you have people who are working and they really can't afford to take off of work for the frequency of visits that we need. And so they can't be a support. They can't afford to stay home for a week and a half after the procedure with you because they just economically can't afford it. So that can be a barrier for people. Many people don't have reliable transportation or, you know, the family sharing a car. And so trying to find reliable transportation can be difficulty. And these can all impact patients. And we can't necessarily address everything, but we can often address a lot of those issues to make it ultimately work for a patient. One of the things probably worth thinking about is also, as we think about ideally helping people live longer after transplant, we often talk about age because about a quarter of the patients we see nowadays are 65 or older. And so age itself is not a barrier to transplant. Having said that, we do talk to people a little bit about the fact that as you get older, as you approach your natural life expectancy, there's often less difference between what would happen on dialysis and transplant in terms of survival. And so we do talk to people a little bit about, you know, before people do a lot of testing, have an abdominal surgery, get started on immune system suppressing medications, it's worth thinking about, is this on balance going to be better for you versus dialysis? So we do have those conversations with folks.
So let's talk about the transplant in and of itself. Can you describe what that dialysis looks like and maybe the like immediate period afterwards?
So there's two ways people can receive transplants, as we discussed, either a deceased donor kidney or a living donor kidney. If people are receiving a living donor kidney, then we schedule that procedure just like we would any other elective procedure with a scheduled date and time for people to come in the hospital. If it's a deceased donor kidney, then people are on the waiting list. And when we think we have a good quality kidney available for them, we give them a call and have them come into the hospital. Once people get to the hospital, either way, we do some final testing to make sure things are okay. We do a new EKG, a new chest x-ray, make sure there's nothing new that's popped up. When people have the transplant itself, we place the kidney transplant up front, low in the pelvis, so we can get it close enough to the bladder to sew in. We sew the transplant kidney into people's bladder separate from their two original kidneys, which we just leave alone. And then we use the blood vessels that supply blood flow to the pelvis to tie in the blood flow for the transplant, which is why we end up getting that CT scan to make sure that those blood vessels look okay.
Who performs that surgery?
So we have a dedicated group of transplant surgeons.
Okay.
Who perform that surgery. In some transplant centers, it's actually the urologist who perform those surgeries, but usually dedicated transplant surgeons who've done general surgery and then really spent a couple of years specifically just focusing on kidney transplant.
Got it. So that's all they do is kidney
transplant. That's
kind
of all they do. Transplants, usually abdominal transplants. So they may do pancreas transplant as well. People will come out usually with a 5 or 6 inch incision on one side of the lower abdomen or the other. Usually people are going to be in the hospital for 3 or 4 days after the procedure. And as long as at the end of those 3 or 4 days, ideally the kidney transplant is working well, the incision looks good, their pain is well controlled, they're eating and drinking okay, up walking around, and tolerating all their new medications, then we'll get them home and then start their outpatient follow-up.
How do you know if a
transplant has taken? Like, what are the markers for success that you're looking for before you discharge a patient?
You know, as people's chronic kidney disease progresses, their kidney numbers, their BUN and their creatinine goes up and up and up and up as their kidney function is declining. After transplant, you'd like to see that BUN and creatinine come back down, showing that your new kidney is getting rid of those waste products appropriately. In addition to looking at the labs, many of our patients, if they've been on dialysis for a long time, often don't make much of any urine. And so you're looking for new urine output, which you'll know is coming from the transplant kidney, showing that it's working, managing people's volume. So those are the two main things that we look at.
I'm going to share a little story. I'm part of the float pool at my hospital, and I floated to the kidney transplant floor once. And one of my patients was a donor, and he had donated a kidney to his daughter the previous day. And the transplant team came in and announced to the father, "Your daughter is making urine this morning." And everyone in the room was so serious about it. And I was kind of in the corner, like tearing up a little bit. This is so beautiful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's great. And we like pee. So
yeah. Yes. Yes. Pee is good. Pee is good. Okay, so that's pretty quick, 3-4 days. And then what about the immediate post-transplant period? So can you talk about like this kind of immediate post-operative time and what you're looking at with these patients and kind of what their trajectory is?
So we often focus, think about our early period as kind of the first 90 days post transplant. But in terms of kidney transplant, if everything goes well, we get people out of the hospital in 3 or 4 days. Usually we will see them back in clinic 3 or 4 days later to start the outpatient follow-up. So we do ask people to stay relatively close to home, relatively close to the transplant center in the early period until they're really recovered, until they know they're doing well with their medications, till they're feeling better and we really know that they're stable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when people get home, we see them back 3 or 4 days later, really because we don't want too much time to go by before we circle back with the patient, make sure they're doing okay with their medications. We kind of re-educate patients about all their medications when they come to the outpatient clinic. We'll talk to people about the lab schedule and about the travel schedule and these kind of things. And then we tend to see people early on weekly to make sure that they're doing well, kidney's doing well. We often need to manage people's blood pressure. For our folks who have diabetes, we need to manage their blood sugar. We often need to manage people's fluid status. And so we try to see them relatively frequently early on to do that. And then as people are doing better, we space out those visits and those blood draws a bit.
This seems like a good time to jump into medications that transplant patients are taking. And my very basic understanding is that these kind of evolve over time. But could you talk about starting with a patient who has very recently received a transplant, what kind of medications are they prescribed?
Sure. So there's basically three categories of medication that people are going to be on. Most people are on what we call a triple drug regimen. So they're on three different anti-rejection medications as the core of their after-transplant regimen. For most people, that involves a calcium urine inhibitor, a medication like tacrolimus or cyclosporin. It involves anti-metabolite medication, usually CellCept or Myfortic, and typically involves steroids, usually prednisone. There are some people who are on some steroid-free regimens. And the amount of medication people are on is greatest early after transplant. And then over the several months following transplant, those doses tend to be reduced somewhat. Once we transplant people, the main thing we want to do is not let your body recognize that there's this foreign piece of tissue in there, that there's this kidney, and try to get rid of it. The way your body recognizes foreign things and tries to get rid of them is with the immune system recognizing proteins that are not yours. And when it recognizes proteins that are not yours, it can either mount an inflammation response to try to kill that abnormal protein, in this case, the kidney transplant, and it can potentially mount antibodies that are directed against that foreign protein. And so, and that inflammation response and that antibody response are what we call rejection. That's the rejection response. And so the medicines people are on after transplant are really designed to tamp down your ability to mount an inflammatory response, to mount a rejection response. The way we do that is recognizing what parts of your body tend to mount that response. Our nurses will be familiar with people's white blood cell count, and we know that within that white blood cell count, there's a number of different cells, that there are white blood cells that are really directed towards bacterial infections. And then there's the lymphocytes, which are typically directed towards fighting viral infections most commonly. Those are also the cells typically involved in rejection. And so our medications, through a couple of different mechanisms, are really designed to keep those lymphocytes from recognizing the kidney transplant. And even if they recognize it, trying to keep them from signaling an inflammatory response, which usually involves making more and more lymphocytes, bringing more lymphocytes in to cause damage. And so our medicines, really through three different mechanisms for the three different medicines, keep the lymphocytes from what we say, keep them from activating and keep them from proliferating. So we keep them from recognizing the kidney in the first place and keep them from really mounting that response.
That's so cool. I think it's fascinating. So besides these, I'll call like anti-rejection medications or the triple drug regimen, what other medications are these patients on?
Sure. So the second main category of people are on is, now that we have put people on these medications that suppress the immune system, you know, our goal is to have the immune system only not recognize the kidney, but of course, it's not that specific. So we're really suppressing the immune system globally and putting people at higher risk for infection. So when people come out from transplant, the additional medications they're on early on are going to be medicines to keep them from getting infected, usually antibiotic, antiviral medications, sometimes antifungal medications. And typically, patients will be on those medications, depending on which category we're talking about, typically somewhere between 1 and 6 months, sometimes a little longer, really just to prevent them from getting sick now that we've placed them on these medications.
Got it. So what are these common, could you call them prophylactic medications?
Yeah, these are prophylactic medications. Perfect.
Yeah. What are some common ones that you give?
Most commonly, there's a lung disease called PJP pneumonia that you really only see in, they're what we call opportunistic infections. So they're infections that you see in people who are suppressed, like transplant patients, HIV patients, cancer patients undergoing chemo. So to prevent this kind of pneumonia, people are usually on Bactrim or some alternative medicines if they're allergic to sulfa. Patients are at risk for another infection called CMV, another opportunistic infection. We put people on a medicine called valganciclovir or Valcyte to prevent that infection. People can develop fungal infections. Most commonly, they'll get thrush, sort of a whitish deposit on their tongue, which can be irritating and sometimes painful. So people will often be on Diflucan or a similar antifungal medication, sometimes by pill, sometimes a liquid medicine that they'll swish around in their mouth to prevent fungal infection. And then our patients may be at higher risk for urinary tract infections. And so often people will be on urine prophylaxis. Sometimes that can be just the same Bactrim that's good for the PJP. We'll cover both. Sometimes people have an additional medicine specifically designed to keep them from getting urine infections.
Got it. What about vitamin supplements?
Yeah. So many of our patients with advanced chronic kidney disease or who are on dialysis will know that often they're on things like phosphorus binders, which they won't need post-transplant. But post-transplant, really early on, we may see things like people's phosphorus getting low, actually, instead of high. So sometimes we actually have to supplement that. We want to preserve people's bone health. And we know that chronic kidney disease tends to be bad for people's bone health, but also the steroids can be bad for bone health. So we focus on making sure we're supplementing people's vitamin D, supplementing calcium as we need to make sure that bones are doing well. And then people are going to need medications for their other underlying diseases. So for instance, if someone comes to transplant and they have type 2 diabetes, they're still going to need their diabetic treatment after transplant. So they may still need their insulin that they were on. If they had high blood pressure, we'll still likely be giving them some high blood pressure lowering medications after transplant.
Got it. I can imagine, you know, thinking through this, that patients before transplant are often being renally dosed with medications. And then once they have the transplant, more renal clearance, that they're going to have to adjust a lot of medications.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons for these weekly visits early on, because things change frequently. And you're right that the dose you were on last week may not be appropriate, really, because your kidney function got better. And now we need to adjust the doses. One of the most common things, and we try to let people know about this ahead of time, actually, interestingly, is for people with diabetes. As you know, insulin is normally metabolized by your kidneys. And so as people develop progressive kidney failure, the insulin they make or the insulin they take just kind of sits around for a long time because it's not being metabolized. Sometimes that means for some of our diabetic folks, as they approach dialysis, they actually come off their insulin. They don't need it anymore.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We recognize a little bit. Sometimes our patients will tell us, they're telling us their story. And they're like, but my diabetes has gotten better. Yeah. You know, which just says to us, like, your kidney function has gotten worse. That's what happened. You know, but that means that, like you said, post-transplant, they've got good kidney function, steadily improving kidney function. It means that many of those folks who didn't require insulin before are going to require insulin again. And for folks who are on insulin, they're likely to require more, sometimes substantially more insulin because it's being metabolized normally. And so we expect that at least weekly, we're making typically upward adjustments in their insulin medication. The other thing, which is a little paradoxic maybe, is that for many of our patients, most of our patients who have an advanced chronic kidney disease also have high blood pressure, largely as a consequence of inadequate kidney function. Once we transplant patients and they have good transplant function, we've really fixed that. We fixed the thing that was really driving most of their high blood pressure. Now, many of our patients will still require some medications because a couple of our transplant medications tend to give you some high blood pressure. So post-transplant, we're treating really a medication side effect. And then, like you said, there can be some adjustments because early on, we have you on the most anti-rejection medications that you're going to be on. And so often we need more blood pressure lowering medicines early on. And then, you know, over the next several months, as we lower the amounts of anti-rejection medication people are on, often we can back down on the amount of blood pressure medication they need as well.
Got it. Which medications, post-transplant medications, increase blood pressure?
So the calcium urine inhibitors, so the tacrolimus or cyclosporin or Envarsus that people are on, tend to cause some blood vessel constriction as well as some salt and water retention. So they tend to raise the blood pressure. And then the steroids. The steroids also cause salt and water retention and can increase the risk of high blood pressure.
Got it. So you mentioned that you initially started a transplant recipient on the triple drug regimen. But can you talk about the process of peeling off these medications and what ultimately they end up on a long-term basis?
We recognize that the early transplant period is the period of highest risk for rejection for people. And over time, that risk declines somewhat. It never goes away, but it goes down over the first 6 to 12 months or so. With that in mind, we have people on the most anti-rejection medication up front. And then typically over the first 3 to 6 months, people's steroid dose, which starts out relatively high, is progressively stepped down. And so people may come out of the hospital, for instance, on 20 milligrams of prednisone each day. And in our center, by the time people are 1 month out, that'll be down to 10 milligrams. And by the time people are 6 months out, they'll be only on 5 milligrams. So it comes down really to a quarter of what they were taking before.
And will they be on that 5 milligrams indefinitely?
They'll be on that indefinitely. Similarly with the tacrolimus or cyclosporin, which are those two medicines account for 99% of the regimens that people are on. We measure levels of those medications. And so we run those medication levels relatively high early on. And over the first 3 to 6 months, we tend to cut those levels down by just about by half. And the result being that the doses people are on often come down by a third or a half of whatever they are on when they first come out of the transplant procedure.
And is that another medication that will be indefinite?
And that'll be indefinite. So when people think about being on these three main anti-rejection medications, they'll be on those lifelong. The doses will change, but being on them will not change.
Okay.
Their prophylactic medications, typically those will come off. And so some of those medicines they only need for 1 month, some they need for 3 months, some they need for 6 months. But generally speaking, by the time you get to 6 months, almost all of that prophylactic medication is gone. So that usually is 3 or 4 additional medications that people can stop taking.
Got it. Let me pose a situation here. Let's say a nurse in a non-transplant center has a patient who is a transplant recipient, perhaps long-term kidney transplant recipient. What should that nurse know or expect from that patient besides maybe the medications? Like, is there anything that's important to look out for these patients or expect that's different than non-transplant patients?
So there's a couple of things. One is just in terms of health maintenance. Our patients are at high risk of skin cancer. And so, you know, each visit is an opportunity to just remind people about skin cancer prevention.
Why is that?
Our medicines tend to make the skin more sensitive to sun damage. And so a combination of people's sun exposure prior to transplant, plus our medicines, plus exposure after transplant increases the risk of usually basal cell and squamous cell cancers. They can be managed typically, but it requires good skin surveillance and just people being cognizant to not sunbathe and these kind of things. The other thing that is really important is that patients don't start or stop any medications without letting their transplant center know. The transplant medications are metabolized by a very common pathway in the liver that's responsible for the metabolism of more than 50% of all the medications out there. And because it's so common, it means there's an opportunity for a lot of medication interactions. There are a number of common medications that increase the levels of our transplant medications. There's a number of common medications out there that will drop the levels of the anti-rejection drugs in people's system. And so it's important that before people start or stop anything, that they check with the transplant center, make sure that it's okay. And if there is an interaction, that we know about that so we can manage it so people don't end up having a rejection episode because they started something else and that got them into trouble.
Can you give an example of a medication that does this?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So we're thinking about common things. So azithromycin. So it's not uncommon. People have an upper respiratory tract infection. They get a Z-Pak. You know, it's a perfectly fine medication, but it increases your tacrolimus or your cyclosporin dose, sometimes substantially, you know, and those, when you get elevated doses, that can impact your kidney function. On the other side of that, there are medications like common seizure medications like Dilantin that can dramatically drop the levels of our drugs and put people at risk for rejection. One timely medication that's worth keeping in mind, given the COVID pandemic, is Paxlovid. You know, Paxlovid is you know, an oral medication now for treatment of COVID infection. It's very effective. And in general, one of the components of that medication is what we call a potent inhibitor of this liver metabolic system. And it can dramatically, dramatically increase the levels of medications in our patients. And so, you know, for patients whose tacrolimus level, we would be running around 5, you know, it can make these levels 45, 50 in a few days, really dangerously high. And it's one of those medications because it's quote unquote safe. Sometimes when people, you know, present to their emergency room, for instance, with COVID, if people don't check with us, they get prescribed, and it's happened a number of times, they get prescribed Paxlovid. We find out because the patient, you know, dutifully lets us know 2-3 days later. But then when we check their levels are really substantially wearingly high.
Oh, that's really good to know. That's really good to know. Are you often, like, I assume that you have patients for whom they don't live near your center, and so they're often presenting to outside hospitals. Are you often, like, in communication with those physicians when they're prescribing new medications for their patients?
We are. Yes, absolutely. And we like to be, you know, people show up in the emergency room, or if they're just in their primary care physician's office and they're thinking about, you know, XYZ medication to start. And then we really encourage our patients to be their own advocates and essentially demand that the local hospital call us. We, you know, we clearly get some phone calls from physicians who are a little annoyed because it's clear that they were essentially forced to call us.
Yeah.
Because the patient, you know, wouldn't accept the therapy until they'd spoken with us. You know, and the majority of the time it's okay, but it's important for us to know, because very commonly people get started on things that are otherwise perfectly fine. They just are problematic for transplant, you know, and we need to know so that we can make appropriate adjustments so that people do well.
Yeah. I think briefly we could talk about, like, rejection and what does rejection look like. And I'm interested to know kind of the average lifespan of a transplanted kidney.
So when we think about how long kidneys last, we often talk about half-life, like how long after all the kidneys that we transplant today, you know, how long before half of them are not working. For a deceased donor kidney, that's somewhere around 13 to 14 years, which is to say for every kidney we do today, 13, 14 years from now, half of them for various reasons are not working, but the other half are still working. And so we certainly have people in the 20s and sometimes in the 30, plus years of transplant. For living donor kidneys, that's more like 16, 17 years, that half point. And some of the really well-matched kidneys may be in more like the 18 to 20 year halfway point. So they can last quite a long time. For young people, we can effectively double their life expectancy with transplant compared to dialysis. So it's a substantial, substantial difference. And perhaps in a good way, many of our long-term kidneys that fail, they fail because the patient died of other reasons, not related to transplant, which, you know, we don't want people to necessarily pass away. But from the transplant standpoint, it's a success. They had a kidney that worked for them until they died of whatever they happened to die of. So that's the success.
Right. And I think it's important to frame it as success isn't best translated in years lived, but in quality of life.
Absolutely.
That they received. Yeah.
Absolutely.
When there's rejection, is it looking the same as kind of traditional run-of-the-mill renal disease, or is there something different about it?
So it tends to be a little different. With native kidney disease, we're typically looking at the creatinine going up, showing that the kidneys aren't clearing waste products well. And then depending on the disease we're talking about, often people have abnormal amounts of microscopic blood or microscopic protein or both in their urine as markers of damage to their kidney filters. In transplant, when we think about rejection as this inflammation and sometimes antibody episode, the things we look at are creatinine going up. So that's still a thing for us, is that if the serum creatinine is going up, that suggests that there's some damage to the kidney. And often that's all we'll see with typical rejection. And then to diagnose rejection, the gold standard for doing that is to do a needle biopsy of the kidney itself. We'll take out with that kidney 10 to 20 kidney filters with kind of the associated structure. And we're really at the most basic level, just looking to see if there's inflammation in there. There really shouldn't be any. So we're looking to see, are there inflammation cells where they really shouldn't be? If there are, we think about the severity of rejection, kind of grading it kind of 0, 1, 2, 3 in terms of increasing severity. And then depending on the severity, we'll kind of let us know treatment. And then we talked about sometimes people have antibody-related rejection. And so we can also, when we biopsy folks, some of these folks, if it's really advanced, some folks will have some blood in their urine. That's not typical unless people have really just stopped their medications altogether. So most commonly will be the creatinine going up. And then when we do the biopsy, we'll be able to also see that there's evidence of antibody depositing in the kidney, which really shouldn't happen. And then again, based on kind of the severity, will kind of guide us to what kind of treatment people need to reverse that rejection.
Got it. I don't want to go too far into the rejection phase here, although it is interesting. I was wondering if you could, like, what are some key points you would like listeners to take away from this discussion?
Yeah. On the pre-transplant side, if I could emphasize anything, it would be that getting people to transplant evaluation in a timely manner is the most important thing. And we can all advocate for patients. So if we can just keep in mind, if that GFR is around 25, we should be thinking about getting people referred for a transplant evaluation.
Absolutely.
So I think that's the key thing. And then through that workup, helping advocate for people and help them through the workup. So on the pre-transplant side. On the post-transplant side, again, we can have a lot of impact. One, for, as we're taking care of patients, is our patients, even on a post-transplant side, although we lower the risk, it's still cardiovascular death that's really the big thing hanging out there. So we can all help our patients to be healthier, to maintain healthy weights, to exercise, good control of high blood pressure, good control of diabetes. Those are going to improve quality of life, improve length of life, and we can all play a part in that. And then just keeping an eye out for medications that get started or stopped, to just be another eye to make sure that we have a good communication with the transplant center so that people don't have medication complications that are avoidable.
Absolutely. That's something I definitely learned today from speaking with you. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Norman. This has been an incredibly helpful discussion today. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. That's all for today. Keep sharing this podcast with your nursing friends and colleagues. It would really mean the world to me. Claim your free CE credit. And until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.